Hello, and welcome back to Series 3 of the Ecocentrics. I'm Tom.
And I'm PK, and we're going to kick off this season with a summary of our summer.
From the flooding we've seen in Greece
to the fires in Maui.
Let's go. Before we dive into too much of the updates of the summer, what have you learned over the summer? Have you seen any articles, read any books, watched any TV shows which have kind of stood out to you as something which is an interesting bit of climate information to point people towards?
I wish I could say I had in some ways, but I actually started a new job. So I did do a lot of reading, but it was about this new job.
I wanted to bring this up because I have read the most amazing book this summer and I could not recommend it enough. So it's called Braiding Sweetgrass.
Braiding Sweetgrass.
And it's all about indigenous wisdom and scientific knowledge and that kind of overlap between the two with an author who is Native American in heritage and actually where science and Native American wisdom can overlap to understand the things that we can do for our planet and actually how we can live in a better balance with our planet overall. I've read a few books in my life, and this is the first book I've ever not been able to put down. It's just been amazing. And if you want a whole new way to look at the world and just interact with the world, I could not recommend it enough.
Wow. Given that I trust your opinion and how much you read and the high recommendation you've just given it, that'll make the top 5 to top 10 of my next books I have to read.
I'm honored that my ability to pass on reading is that highly ranked. So let's talk about what we're talking about today. We're going to be thinking about a few different things that have gone over the summer. And as human beings, we are always biased to things that happened more recently, but we'll dig through some of the things that have been going on. And to start with, we'll be thinking about the planetary boundaries. And only a couple of days ago, there was a major update. And we talked about the planetary boundaries in some of our previous episodes, maybe just looking at them in passing. And what the planetary boundaries are a bit of a framework, a bit of a tool for us to understand the health of our Earth system. So it's been created by system scientists, and the first model came out in around about 2009, giving us this health check for the planet, thinking about some really key indicators which have been stable for the 12,000 years that human beings have had agriculture for. And really thinking, are we pushing the limit of those boundaries? And are we going into an area of uncertainty? So the idea of the planetary boundaries is to map where we are on some of those things. So things like climate change, we're obviously all familiar with. Biodiversity loss, again, something we're all familiar with. Ozone depletion, chemicals leaching into our systems, water health. And actually thinking where we are in terms of the risks and the potential destabilizing forces which could be coming in as we move into this area of uncertainty, as the scientists like to call it. Scientists over the last year or so have been collating all of the academic literature. I think it's around about 2,000 papers they've been through to look at here. And they've given us an updated risk assessment. And how do you think we did, PK?
I've just gone to physics.org and I'm reading it and I'm like, ah!
Yeah, yeah. Not the best news in terms of our planetary health system, because dun dun dun, things have got worse. We have continued to overshoot the limits within our planetary system. And as I say, we're moving in towards this area of risk. And it basically means our planetary system is less resilient to some of the shocks that we're throwing at it. And this report is kind of saying, at the moment, we're not certain that the planet is going to have a heart attack, but actually we've got really high blood pressure. So using that health analogy that I know you absolutely love, PK.
I'm looking at the images from the planetary boundaries from 2009, 2015, 2022, and now 2023. And it's clear, if this was your health reading, we would be right on the cusp of needing emergency statins.
And it's not to say things aren't going positively as well. And we will talk about some of the positive things that happened over the summer too. But our systems-wise, we've got a lot to do. And we need to start thinking about these things better. And I think it really nicely leads us onto a discussion that we need to have on this podcast in more detail in terms of actually how do we, as a global civilization, as members of a global civilization, think about how we live within the planetary boundaries? How do we live within limits? And I know donut economics, something that we've talked about in passing several times on this, helps us start to think about that. And hopefully we can have a bit more of a discussion as we go into series three about what donut economics is and how it's a tool to think about living within a safe space for the planet.
We've overreached and we've overstepped.
There was a wonderful podcast series I've listened to. So if you need to turn this off immediately, I'm going to recommend you go to the other podcast I've listened to this summer, which thinks about the limits to our planetary systems. And it goes all the way back to some of the early work in the 1970s by people like Donella Meadows, most amazing systems thinkers, thinking about actually all of our different parts of our Earth system are interconnected, the way we interface with it, the way that our systems interface with it, our biological world, and our social structures all interact. And back in the 70s, we realized that there were limits to what we could do, and we haven't heeded the warnings of scientists. And as I'm sure many of you will see, the old quote floating around Facebook and other places, that the disaster movies always start by people not listening to scientists. And we will learn about this in the 70s, and we still haven't done anything. At least things are becoming clear now for us to think about the fact that we know what the problems are, and we know we need to bring ourselves into these safe spaces.
Yeah, whether it's Jeff Goldblum in Jurassic Park, or it's our actual real scientists, no one seems to listen. So next up, we're going to be discussing the nutrient neutrality issue that came up in Parliament this week. And Tom, I think you're ahead of me on this, but something that always strikes me as an American when we're talking about the House of Lords and the House of Commons, you know, as an American, we don't have these inherited positions that you have for life. And my husband's always talked to me about how the House of Lords has sometimes been the vote of reason and kept things from going off the rails. And in this particular case, I think that would serve true to purpose.
I feel weird saying, oh, the House of Lords, that's a good thing, isn't it? And we'll dig into a second exactly what they've done and why they're doing things well. But I am starting to think the House of Lords is probably good as a bit of a check and balance in our system.
I don't like the inherited thing. I don't like necessarily the peer for life. But the thing is, you can then actually vote the way you want to, because you don't have to worry about what's going to happen to you. Again, pros and cons, but in this case, they helped us, didn't they?
Yeah. And the reason they've helped us, the UK government earlier this week, so we're recording this on Friday 15th, they decided that they were going to scrap some of these nutrient neutrality laws. So the idea of nutrient neutrality is that developers, so people building houses, doing all of these things, any nutrients that go into the water system as a result of their developments, they have to offset the impacts by storing those nutrients elsewhere. And mainly when we're talking about nutrients in this sense, we're talking about phosphates and nitrates. And as some of you may recall from our previous season, there's a lot of phosphates and nitrates in our water course. Not only because of developers and the way we build houses, but also because we love to pump poop into our water. So there is a whole load of these chemicals floating around in our water system already. And by slashing back these laws, cutting back regulations, going with ideological dogma, we allow more of them to enter our water course. Why? The big reason really is because they have limited the development of house building. And there's a question here in terms of the fundamental challenge around house building in the UK and the fact that there aren't enough houses being built. If you come from certain philosophies, in reality, we probably should think about how we use our house better. But actually, this was a way to facilitate more house development and stop holding the developers back in terms of the amount of houses they were creating.
Yeah, and especially we understand everybody has, you know, the access and the rights to housing, but we do need to consider housing, how many houses we build, because as we know, every time we sort of clear a field, you don't get that back, but you do create a lot of environmental destruction. You know, when you're thinking about that, it creates more flooding. It reduces biodiversity. You are getting new housing, but then you are potentially impacting other housing down the road or other buildings or businesses with flooding that we just won't be able to manage. And flooding, you know, from I think the most recent reports, flooding is one of the biggest major issues that we have to deal with in the UK in terms of climate change.
It's this question of what do we value more, our water systems, which are already, none of them are in good ecological health, or developing more houses. And I think there's a balance to be made here, but actually the balance is probably thinking how important are these water systems in sustaining our lives more generally? And you make a really important point about flooding in the UK. And more I'm seeing the conversation pop up when I speak to people, the insurance premiums are changing because my house is going to be impacted by flooding. And actually the insurance market, love it or hate it, may also start to drive things forward. But swinging back around to the point that we made at the beginning of this nutrient neutrality discussion, the big part of what's happened with the House of Lords and why that's important with all of this is that the House of Lords kicked the bill out on Thursday this week, saying that this doesn't work. The government was trying to put it as part of the levelling up agenda, but the House of Lords said this is unacceptable and we can't have it. So the House of Lords worked as a useful check and balance on government power.
Once again, Lord Devon, the ex-cabinet minister and the former chair of the Climate Change Committee, who I feel like I'm falling in love with, also voted against that as well. I think I'm going to have to write him a really sweet email, or old school, a letter.
Hand-delivered by pigeons.
Sustainable pigeons. What's this global stock take?
So the global stock take is something which was created as part of the Paris Climate Change Agreement. In 2015, it was agreed that all countries would come back in 2023 and show their emissions reduction targets. So basically, we have an overview of how the world's been doing and also how things are looking moving forward as well. So we can start to see what the emissions reductions for the Paris Agreement look like. The idea behind this is that we ratchet things down to bring us closer and closer to 1.5 degrees in terms of the emissions reductions that we're seeing. The report said that we were still shockingly off track and we were still weren't doing enough to keep 1.5 degrees alive.
That's not surprising. I probably could have written this report.
And I know that comes as no surprise to regular listeners to the podcast or people that meet me in the street as I rant. And the reality is actually that we are a fair way off the mark still. So looking at kind of tons of emissions that need to be cut by 2030, if we're going to keep 1.5 alive, we need to cut the emissions that are going to be emitted into the atmosphere by 22 billion tons. And just to give us a bit of a reference point for what that really means, that is the same as the combined emissions of China, US, India, Russia, and Japan. And we need to take them off.
Gosh.
There have been some interesting reports that have gone alongside this. In particular, the International Energy Agency, and we've talked about them before, slightly conservative in their estimates of how things work, but they think we're going to be peaking demand for fossil fuels in the next couple of years.
That is good news.
Not supply. There's a big question about the fact that oil companies, fossil fuel states still going to pull up more and they want to sell it into the market. But demand should peak in the next few years. Technology is dirt cheap. The reality is we can move over to renewables, which save us all money. And the market is starting to realize some of those things. And I don't want to promote the market as the way we do these things because the market is not neutral. It's set by the rules that we give it as people who think about policy as individuals. But things are starting to change.
That is some nice, healthy, good news. And I think we should always have a little bit of that in the podcast. So thank you. All right. So we've talked about that. Are we going to cover some of the costs of the heat waves and flooding as well?
Yeah. And it's devastating to see some of the impacts around the world this year.
Every week, a new disaster around the globe. The Maui fires feel like last year almost. But the whole time that was happening, it was just astonishing to watch, really. But there are things that we don't think about. So when it happens on a smaller island, obviously we've had the wildfires in Greece as well, also devastating, but at least it's closer to larger land masses. In smaller countries or smaller geographic areas like Maui, when you have those wildfires, they're out in the middle of nowhere. To try to get the supplies to rebuild would take significantly longer. To try to get the food, you know, the temporary shelter, the emergency care workers, all of whom are probably trying to save their own houses as well. You know, when it's happened in the United States and we've had this happen in, say, Louisiana, and I was working for an organization in Florida, the state of Florida is right there. Georgia's there. Alabama's there. You send all your law enforcement, you send your major emergency teams, and the other states come really quickly to that geographic area to support because you need it. can't do it. And that's going to be happening to more and more of our islands that are dotted around in big, large bodies of water that are far, far away from a landmass with a labor supply and with actual goods and supplies as well.
And we obviously all know about the human and social cost of all of these things. But Allianz, the banking group, did some analysis of the financial cost as well. And looking at the heat waves that have gone on through 2023, they have calculated that on average, global GDP has lost 0.6 percentage points as a result of the heat wave of 2023 alone. Not thinking about flooding, not thinking about the other impacts, just heat waves.
Just the heat waves.
And in China, it's 1.3 percentage point. So an even bigger chunk in China.
Double.
And I think it's really interesting to think about some of these framings as well. I was at a conference over the summer, and previously when I've been to some of these things, it's thinking about net zero, mitigation, action. All of a sudden, this is the first conference that I've been to when the framing is about resilience and adaptation. We're recognizing that the impacts are here. Therefore, we need to think about how we're going to be resilient to those impacts moving forward.
Yeah. And I'm thinking in terms of business, because you and I both have jobs that relate to this, and we work with a whole host of different kinds of businesses. That's actually becoming more and more important from the conversations I can see from them. They can start to understand, oh, if there's massive flooding and we have a factory here and there's two bridges that cross this flooding zone, maybe our factory isn't in danger of being flooded. But if those bridges get washed out or those roads are eroded, then that means our supply chain won't get to our factory, which means we can't produce our product. And also our employees can't get to the factory, you know, so it's becoming being resilient, adapting and ensuring that the organization can stand on a solid footing is becoming more and more important to businesses. And that might be starting to get to be where we can make some big dents towards climate change.
And we will only see these impacts continue.
Oh, we've got climate criminals next, don't we?
Yeah.
Last series, we introduced something called the Anti-Nobel Prize, but we're going to reclassify that and call it climate criminals from now on. And I think, Tom, you have a climate criminal, don't you?
It is Theresa, really is. Some of you may remember her as Secretary of State for the Environment, Food and Rural Affairs up until around about February 2020. But it was disclosed over the summer that during her time in post, the lovely Theresa had £70,000 invested in Shell. And she had all of her other investments nicely lined out. But her investments in Shell, just no one talked about them. Maybe they don't want to think about the fact that was maybe a vested interest in terms of her role as Secretary of State for the Environment. So, Theresa, our first Climate Criminal Award goes to you.
And actually, on that note, for any of our listeners, this is something to consider. You actually may have your pensions unknowingly invested in fossil fuels. And one of the best things you can do to start helping towards drawing down emissions is just checking in with your pension plans. And most companies, most organizations have an opportunity or a way for you to divest from fossil fuels and into green pensions. We'll have an episode about this at a later date.
Here we go. It's the summer update quiz,
which I'm sure I'll fail.
As long as you get at least one question right, I'll be proud of you, PK.
It's such a low bar.
Question uno. Are we ready? This summer, which UK newspaper was found to have launched a misinformation campaign on electric vehicles to keep the era of the fossil fuel car alive for longer? So which paper was it? Was it the Financial Times? Was it everyone's favourite, the Daily Express? The Daily Mail? Or was it lefties' favourites, the Guardian?
I'm going to say the Daily Mail.
Ding, 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 ding,
excellent.
It was the Mail.
I'm not familiar with the Daily Express, so I don't know where that stands.
Yeah, just go and look at one newspaper stand and you'll get the feeling where they are, all right?
Okay. Well, I got one right. Yay. I've not failed entirely.
And just a quote from this paper, they were saying that the environmental benefits of the electric car may never be felt, spreading misinformation about the life cycle impacts.
Yeah. Number two.
True or false? This summer has been the hottest summer globally on record.
True.
Oh, two out of two. We're on for a record here. Right. Last season, we talked a lot about sewage discharge. Yummy, yummy, I know. Has there been any change in the news about sewage discharge? Option one, no, I still eat poop whenever I swim in a river. Option two, there's a legal case being brought against some of our water companies for discharging sewage at times when it wasn't even raining. Or actually, yes, the problem is fixed. No poop in my mouth. Thank you very much.
I'm going to say two.
And this is exciting. There is a legal case going against some of the big water companies who are doing what's called dry spilling, such as chucking sewage out even when it wasn't raining.
Next question.
Finishing here then. Over summer, figures for quarter one of the energy generation mix of the UK were released. Thinking about that, what percentage of energy came from renewables in Q1 in the UK? Was it 10%, 25%, 33%, or 50%?
I'm going to say C. Or was it D?
So the correct answer is 50%. So it's actually 47 point something percent. So almost half of our electricity in the depths of winter came from renewable energy. And that is a glimmer of hope that we can see there.
That is a glimmer of hope. Yeah, that's nice. Good news.
So we've made it to the end. We've finished episode one of season three.
We'll be back next week.
And as always, if you want to get in touch, our email is hello@theecocentrics.com.
And you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, LinkedIn, and Threads.
Bye!
Ciao!